Out of the bush came a little brown honey guide, and he sang thus. Jan Sharoot imitated the high-pitched burring call and fluttered his fingers in an uncanny imitation of the bird. Come, he called to us. Come, follow me, and I will lead you to the hive. But he wasn't a real honey bird, was he, Jan Sharoot? Geordie cried excitedly. No, Geordie, he wasn't a real honey bird. And you followed him. And we followed him for many days through bad country. Even when Master Zuga, your father, would have turned back, old Jan Sharoot was firm. We must go on, I told him. For by this time I, who have a deep knowledge and understanding of ghosts and spirits, realized that this was not a real honey bird, but a hobgoblin in the guise of a bird. Zuga smiled softly. He remembered the incident differently. They had followed the bird for some hours, and it was Jan Sharoot who had lost interest in the hunt and had to be prodded and cajoled to continue. Then suddenly, Jan Sharoot paused and flung out both hands theatrically. Before our eyes, a wall of grey stone rose out of the bush, a wall so high it was like a mountain. With my axe, I chopped away the vines and found a great gateway guarded by fierce spirits.
Spirits? Zuga smiled.
They were invisible to ordinary eyes, Jan Sharoot explained loftily, and I put them to flight with a magical sign.
Zuga winked at Pickering, but Jan Sharoot ignored their smiles.
Beyond the gateway was a temple yard, in which lay the falcon statues cast down, some of them shattered, but all of them covered with heaps of gold, mountains of gold.
Zuga sighed. 50 pounds weight, to be exact, fragments and tiny pieces which we had to lift and sift from the soil. How I wish it had been a mountain.
We gathered the gold from where it lay, and we took up that statue on our shoulders and carried it 1,000 miles,
complaining every step of the way, Zuga pointed out,
until we reached Cape Town again.
It was after midnight when Jan Sharoot brought the saddled horses to the campfire, and as Rhodes took the reins, he paused in the act of mounting.
Tell me, Major, this land to the north, this Zambezia, as you call it in your book, what is it that keeps you from it? What are you doing here?
I need money, Zuga told him simply.
And somehow I know that the road to the north begins here. The money to take and hold Zambezia will come from the workings of New Rush. I like a man who thinks big. A man who counts not in ones and twos, but in tens of thousands.
Rhodes nodded approval.
At this moment I count my fortune in ones and twos. We could change that.
Rhodes shot a pale, piercing glance towards the bird carving. But Zuga chuckled and shook his head.
I would like first refusal,
Rhodes persisted. If I sell, it will be to you, Zuga agreed. And Rhodes stepped up in the stirrup, swung a leg over the horse's rump, settled in the saddle, and rode out of the camp. Pickering edged his mount closer to Zuga and leaned down from the saddle to tell him seriously,
He will have it from you. In the end, he will have it.
I think not. Zuga shook his head. But Pickering smiled. He always gets what he sets his heart on. Always. He saluted Zuga with the hand that held the reins, and then started his horse into a canter and followed Rhodes out onto the dusty starlit track.
Give this stone to the yellow man, Camusa urged quietly. 500 gold queens and we will return to our people with treasures. Your father, the Induna of Inyati, will be pleased. Even the king will call us to the great kraal at Dabas in Dunas for audience. We will become important men.
I do not trust the bastard.
Do not trust him. Trust only the yellow coins he brings.
I do not like his eyes. They are cold and he hisses like a yellow cobra when he speaks. They were silent then. A circle of dark figures in the smoky hut, squatting around the diamond as it lay on the clay floor and flickered with weird lights in the reflection of the fire. They had argued since the sunset. They had argued over the meal of stringy mutton, with its rind of greasy fat and maize porridge, baked until it was stiff as cake. They had argued over the snuff horn and beer pot, and now it was late. Soon, very soon, there would be a scratching at the door of the hut as the bastard came for his answer.
"The stone is not ours to sell. It belongs to Bakela. Does a son sell the calves from his father's herds?"
Camuza made a clucking sound of exasperation.
"Surely it is against law and custom to steal from the tribe, from the elders of the tribe. But Bakela is not Matabili. He is Buni. He is white man. It is not wrongdoing to take from him any more than it is against law and custom to send the assegai through the hut of a Mashona dog, or to mount his wife in sport, or to take the cattle of a Tswana and put fire in his kraal to hear his children squeal. Those are natural and right things for a man to do."
"Bakela is my father. The stone is his calf, given into my care."
"He will give you a single coin," Camuza lamented,
and Butso seemed not to hear him. He picked up the diamond again and turned it in his hand.
"It is a large stone," he mused aloud. "A very large stone."
He held it to his eye and looked into the stone as though it were a mountain pool. And he watched with awe the fires and shapes move within it. Still holding it to his eye, he said,
"If I bring my father a newborn calf, he will be happy and give me a reward. But if I bring him 100 calves, how much greater will be his joy, and 100 times greater the reward that he will give me."
He lowered the stone and gave a series of orders that sent his men hurrying out into the night to return immediately with the tools Butso had sent them to fetch. Then in silence they watched him make his preparations. Firstly, he spread a kaross of silver jackal pelts on the earth floor, and then in the centre of the fur he placed a small steel anvil, at which he had watched Zuga shaping horseshoes and working the iron hoops to repair the wagon wheels. On the anvil, Butso placed the diamond, and then he threw aside his cloak so that he stood stark naked in the firelight, tall and lean and hard, his belly muscles standing up in concentric ridges under the dark, satiny skin, and the wide, rangy shoulders overdeveloped by practice with shield and spear. With his legs braced wide, he stood over the anvil and hefted the sweat-polished handle of the pick, feeling the balance and weight of the steel head that had become so familiar. Butso narrowed his eyes, measuring his stroke, and then he reared back with the pick almost touching the thatched roof. He drove his body weight into the stroke, and the steel pick head came hissing down from on high. The point caught the diamond exactly on the high centre of its curved upper surface, and the great stone exploded as though a bucketful of mountain water had been dashed to the earth. The sparkling drops, the shattered fragments, the glowing chips of priceless crystal seemed to fill the whole hut with a burst of sunlight. They pattered against the thatched walls, stung the naked skins of the watching Matabili, kicked little puffs of grey ash as they fell into the fire, and scattered on the lustrous fur of the silver jackal kaross, shining there like live fish in the net.
"Son of the great snake," hooted Camuza joyously, "we are rich men."
And the laughing Matabili flung themselves into the task of gathering up the fragments. They picked them from the ashes, swept them up from the earthen floor, shook them out of the jackal skin kaross, and piled them into Butso's cupped hand, until it was filled to overflowing. Even then they missed some of the tiny chips that had fallen into the dust or the fire and were lost forever.
"You are a wise man,"
Camuza told Butso with unaffected admiration.
"Bakela has his stones, 100 calves, and we will have more coins than the yellow bastard would give us."
There was no work in the collapsed number 6 section. No need to rise before dawn. So the sun was clear of the horizon when Zuga strode out of the tent, clinching his belt as he joined Yan Shirut and the two boys under the camel-thorn tree. The table was a packing case, the lid stained with candle grease and spilled coffee. and breakfast was maize meal porridge in chipped enamel bowls, unsweetened, for the price of sugar had recently risen to £1 to £1 on the diamond fields. Zuga's eyes were red-rimmed, for he had slept little the previous night, but had lain awake worrying and scheming, going over and over in his mind every detail of the plans for the new staging, and coming back each time to the most important detail, the one for which there seemed to be no solution. The cost, the enormous cost of it all. The two boys saw his face, recognised his mood, and were immediately silent, applying themselves with complete absorption to the unappetising grey gruel in their bowls. A shadow fell across the group, and Zuga looked up irritably, squinting into the early sunlight, with the spoon half raised to his lips. "What is it, Butzo?" "Pickups, Bakela." The tall young Matabele used the English words. "Pickups," Zuga grunted. "Let me see it." Zuga was immediately uninterested. Almost certainly it would be a worthless chip of quartz or rock crystal. But Butzo placed a small bundle wrapped in a dirty scrap of cloth beside Zuga's bowl. "Well, open it," Zuga ordered, and Butzo picked the knot and spread the cloth. "Glass," thought Zuga disgustedly. There was almost a handful of it, chips and pieces, the biggest not much bigger than the head of a wax vesta. "Glass!" And he made the gesture of sweeping it away, and then stayed his hand as the sunlight fell on the pile, and a shaft of it pricked his eyes in a rainbow burst of colours. Slowly, disbelievingly, he changed the gesture of dismissal, reached hesitatingly, almost reverently, for the glittering heap. But Jordan forestalled him. With a shriek of joy, the child's small, graceful fingers danced over the pile. "Diamonds, Papa!" he screamed. "They're diamonds, real diamonds!"
"Are you sure, Geordie?" Zuga asked the question unnecessarily, his voice hoarse, realising it was too good to be true. There must be many hundreds of precious stones in the pile. Small, very small, but of what superb colour! White, ice white, seeming to crackle like lightning, they were so bright. Still hesitantly, Zuga took one of the largest stones from Jordan's fingers. "Are you sure, Geordie?" he repeated. "They are diamonds, Papa, all of them." Zuga's last doubts faded, to be replaced immediately by a deeper uncertainty. "Butzo," he said, "there are so many." And then something else puzzled him. Quickly he picked out 20 of the largest stones and stood them in a row across the top of the packing case. "The same colour? They are all the same colour, exactly." Zuga shook his head, frowning, confused. And then suddenly the shadows in his eyes cleared. "Oh, my God," he whispered, and slowly all blood drained from his face, leaving the skin dirty yellow, like a man 10 days gone in malaria fever. "The same. They are all the same. The breaks are clean and fresh." Slowly he lifted his eyes to Butzo's face. "Butzo, how big?" His voice roughened and dried, so that he had to clear his throat. "How big was the stone before you cracked it?" "This big," Butzo clenched and showed his first. "With my pick, I made it into many stones for you, Bakela, knowing how you value many stones." Zuga's voice was still a husky whisper. "I will kill you," he said in English. "For this, I will kill you." The scar across his cheek turned slowly into an ugly, inflamed wheel, the stigmata of his rage, and now he was shaking, his lips trembling, as he rose slowly to his feet. "I will kill you!" His voice rose to a bellow, and Jordan shrieked again, this time with terror. He had never seen his father like this before. There was a terrifying, maniacal quality about him. "That was the stone I was waiting for, you bastard! You black bastard, that was it! That was the key to the north!" Zuga snatched the Martini Henry rifle from where it leaned against the bole of the camel thorn tree beside the falcon carving.
The steel clashed and snickered as he pumped a cartridge into the chamber and in the same moment swung up the barrel.
"I am going to kill you!"
he roared, and then checked. Ralph had jumped to his feet, and now he faced his father, stepping forward until the muzzle of the loaded and fully cocked rifle almost touched the entwined brass snakes of his belt buckle.
"You'll have to kill me first, Papa," he said.
He was as pale as Zuger, his eyes the same deep, haunted green.
"Get out of the way!"
Zuger's voice sank into that croaking, husky whisper. And Ralph could not answer him, for he shook his head, his heavy jaw clenched so determinedly that his teeth grated audibly.
"I warn you, stand aside."
Zuger choked, and they stood confronting each other, both trembling with tension and outrage. Then the muzzle of the heavy rifle wavered in Zuger's hands, lowered slowly, until it pointed to the dusty red earth between the toes of Ralph's boots. Silence went on for many seconds. Then Zuger took a full breath, and the barrel of his chest swelled under the faded blue flannel shirt. With a gesture of utter frustration, he hurled the rifle against the tree trunk, and the butt snapped through. Then he sank back into his seat at the packing case table, and his golden head sank slowly into his hands.
"Get out!"
All the fire and fury had gone from his voice. It was quiet and hopeless.
"Get out, all of you."
Zuger sat on alone under the thorn tree. He felt burned out with emotion and anger, empty and blackened and devastated within, like the felt after fire has swept through it. And when at last he lifted his head, the first thing he saw was the falcon squatting opposite him on its green stone plinth. It seemed to be smiling, a cruel and sardonic twist to the predator's beak. But when he stared at it, Zuger saw that it was merely a trick of shadow and sunlight through the thorn branches. The copywalloper was a small man with legs so short that his polished high-heeled boots did not touch the floor when he sat on the swivel piano stool behind his desk. The desk filled most of the tiny galvanized iron hut, and it was furnace hot in the room. The heat quivered and danced down from the roof. On the raw deal planks of the desk stood the accoutrement of the copywalloper's trade. The whiskey bottle and shot glasses to mellow the man with stones to sell. The sheet of white paper on which to examine the goods for colour. The wooden tweezers, the jeweller's eyeglass, the balance and scales, and the checkbook. The checkbook was the size of a family Bible, each check form embossed in gold leaf and printed in multicolours, the border depicting choirs of heavenly angels, sea nymphs riding in half clam shells drawn by teams of leaping dolphins, the Queen as Britannia with helmet, shield and trident, twisting cornucopia from which poured the treasures of empire and a dozen other patriotic symbols of Victorian might. The checkbook was by far the most impressive item in the hut, not excepting the buyer's flowing silk ascot tie and the yellow spats that covered his boots. It was unlikely that a digger would be able to refuse payment offered in such flamboyant style. "How much, Mr. Werner?" Zuger asked. Werner had swiftly sorted the glittering heap of diamond chips into separate piles, grading them by size alone, for each stone was of the same fine white colour. The smallest stones were 3 points, 3/100 parts of a carat, barely bigger than a grain of beach sand. The largest was almost a carat. Now Werner laid aside his tweezers and ran his hand through his dark locks. "Have another whiskey," he murmured, and when Zuger refused, "Well, me, I'm having one now." He poured both glasses full to the brim, and despite Zuger's frown, pushed one across to him.
"How much?" Zuger persisted.
"The weight?" Werner sipped the whiskey and smacked his thick liver-coloured lips.
96 carats, all told. What a diamond it must have been. We will never see the likes again. How much in cash?" "Major, I would have offered you £50,000 if that had been a single stone."
Zuger winced and blinked his eyes closed for an instant, as though he had been slapped across the face with an open hand. With £50,000, he could have taken Zambezia. Money for men, horses and guns. Money for wagons and bullock teams. Machinery to mine the reef and mill the gold. Money for the farms, the seed and implements. He opened his eyes again. "Damn you, I'm not interested in what might have been," he whispered. "Just tell me how much you will pay for that."
£2,000, that's my top price, and it's not an open offer."
The stone had splintered into almost 200 chips. That meant a pick-up payment to Butso of that many sovereigns. Zuga would intensely resent having to make that payment, but he owed it, and he would make it. Of what remained after paying Butso, at least 1,000 would go for his share of the new stagings on the number 6 section. 800 left, and it cost him 100 a week to work his claims, so he had won himself 2 months. 60 days instead of a land. 60 days instead of 100,000 square miles of rich land. "I'll take it," he said quietly, picked up the whiskey glass and drained it. It burned away the bitter taste at the back of his throat.